ability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Val, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Sunday, August 16th issue of the New York Times Business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The lead article is titled, "What Does Big Tech Owe the Public?" With AI trillions at stake, political pressure is mounting to share the wealth, by Tony Rahm. In a nation on the precipice of a technological revolution, there are few states quite like Virginia, where hundreds of warehouses full of powerful and power-hungry computers have earned one region the nickname Data Center Alley. So it was all the more surprising when Virginia lawmakers decided in late June to take aim at the industry they had long helped to incubate. Capping a year of hard-fought negotiations, the state became the first in the country to impose a small tax on data centers based on the vast amounts of electricity they consume. For the trillion-dollar behemoths that own or lease data centers, including Amazon and Microsoft, the tax represented a fraction of what they might someday earn from artificial intelligence. But for Virginia, it will be a windfall, supplying about $600 million next year in needed revenue, according to L. Louise Lucas, a Democratic state senator. The rapid proliferation of data centers has raised new economic and environmental costs, she said, and the tech industry needs to shoulder more of the burden. How do we let the wealthiest companies in human history come to the Commonwealth, Ms. Lucas said, and not play by the same rules as everyone else? The debate in Virginia is part of a larger reckoning now underway in American politics. From the smallest city councils to the corridors of power in Washington, policymakers are rethinking their economic relationship with artificial intelligence, trying to ensure their communities stand to benefit more clearly from a technology that may mint Silicon Valley an incalculable new fortune. With AI, the nation's largest tech companies are seeking to revolutionize almost every field imaginable, from medical research to warfare. But among Americans, there is a growing fear that the financial gains of any breakthroughs may not be shared, or worse, they may become at their direct expense. Jobs would be lost. Industries could be destroyed. Natural resources could be drained. Entire communities could be reshaped by AI with little guarantee that the public would be protected. The disparity has sought off a new debate in Washington about whether and how the government should share in the wealth of AI companies and redistribute their profits. Among state and county officials, meanwhile, there is a new push to tax or otherwise regulate the industry. And hundreds of communities, led by Democrats and Republicans alike, have already tried to ban the construction of data centers, at least temporarily, as they sort through the economic implications. AI companies have argued that they can work with governments to contain job losses or other downsides. But their generosity has its limits, and political groups that represent big tech have lobbied against proposals they see as too demanding, setting up clashes around the country with communities that believe they are owed more. The result has transformed AI into one of the most salient political issues in the 2026 midterm elections, and the outcome could shape the trajectory of the U.S. economy for decades to come. We should be asking, what does AI owe us? Said Betsy Stevenson, a professor of public policy at the University of Michigan and a chief economist at the Labor Department during the Obama administration. "What is my rightful inheritance from AI?" she said. Boom or doom. At the heart of the AI policy debate are two possibilities. The first is that AI will create an unfashionable economic boom, perhaps adding more than $15 trillion to the world's economic output by 2030. The forecast alone has supercharged the valuations of major tech companies, which now represent a lopsided proportion of the Standard & Poor's 500. Two young AI firms, Anthropic and OpenAI, are considering public stock offerings that may value both at $1 trillion or more. The second possibility is a doomsday brought about by that same pursuit of growth. If AI falters, it could cause a catastrophe for markets. Well, if AI succeeds, it could leave millions of Americans unemployed. And it could concentrate more wealth in the hands of a few, like Elon Musk, who briefly became the world's first trillionaire after one of his companies, SpaceX, went public in June. The two paths have started a new chapter in the long-running political debate about inequality in America, where major economic transformations, from electrification to the deluge of cheap Chinese exports, have parceled out their costs and benefits disproportionately. The scars of that history are evident in countless towns that had factories and storefronts darken as the economy globalized. With AI, the effects of automation largely have not yet been felt. There are no mass layoffs, for example, with robots replacing humans at scale. But the fear alone has helped provoke countless protests against the technology at all levels of government, even surfacing at one of President Trump's rallies last month. "The political pressure is growing because people are worried," said Brent Orel, a co-director of a joint AI commission started by the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative-leaning group, and the Urban Institute, a left-leaning group. "They're worried about their economic well-being, and they see this as another threat." The concerns led roughly 200 economists, industry leaders, and former regulators to issue a warning in July, led by Eric Bjornjolfsson, a Harvard-Stanford economist and AI expert. Their joint statement, "We must act now," urged governments everywhere to build the incentives, guardrails, and institutions needed to steer AI in a direction that complements humans and benefits society. That conversation is only just beginning in hyperpartisan Washington, where AI carries high stakes for a country that derives much of its tax revenue from workers' and businesses' incomes. It has stoked another timeless debate about the role of the federal government, the balance it should strike as facilitator of AI growth, and as a caretaker for those who may be harmed. AI and robotics are by far the most transformative technologies in the history of humanity, Senator Bernie Sanders, the Vermont Independent, said in an interview. "They have an enormous impact on our economy and the possibility that many millions of jobs that will be lost." Already, some in Congress have tossed around a battery of ideas, including new taxes that would apply to AI company services and calls for a rethink of corporates. Particularly among Democrats, there is a desire to capture more money for the federal budget. The United States has a debt approaching $40 trillion, and it might grow further if Washington is forced to provide a financial cushion for those displaced by AI. Mr. Sanders has proposed that the U.S. government try to offset those consequences directly by taking a 50% stake in major AI companies. Under his plan, the United States would impose a one-time tax on tech giants paid in equity to a newly established sovereign wealth fund. That fund would be worth about $7 trillion based on current valuations. With the money, the government could immediately make a payment of more than $1,000 to all Americans, Mr. Sanders estimates, and then continue to redistribute any additional wealth as it is generated. The idea is not without precedent in the United States. For decades, Alaska has paid small dividends to its residents based on the sale of oil extracted within its borders. The amount is hardly enough to replace a person's wages, but for some economists, the fund is a tempting model for the digital age. If data is the oil for the nation's AI giants, supporters reason, then the wealth they stand to generate from the world's information should be shared in kind. Mr. Sanders is not the only one floating such an option. Even his ideological foe, Mr. Trump, has mused about the public owning a portion of OpenAI. While the president generally has supported the pace of AI development and castigated those who have stood in its way, he still signaled this year that he hoped to convene tech executives to discuss whether to take stakes in their companies. In theory, some industry leaders, including Sam Altman, the chief executive of OpenAI, and Dario Amodei, the chief executive of Anthropic, support policies that distribute AI wealth to citizens. Mr. Altman has even lobbied Mr. Trump on the matter. Others, like Mr. Musk, have similarly called for universal high income via checks issued from the federal government. To date, though, none of the major tech companies has endorsed specific state or federal legislation, including the proposal from Mr. Sanders. Instead, they primarily opted to call for studies. OpenAI and Anthropic declined to comment. The New York Times has sued OpenAI and Microsoft, claiming copyright infringement of news content related to AI systems. The two companies have denied the suit's claim. But some experts are not sold on the idea of the government taking a stake, which could end up benefiting the AI companies more than the people who are disrupted by technology. A government that stands to profit from AI giants could be less inclined to regulate those companies in a way that could undermine their value. The prospect for abuse is so vast that everyone should be uncomfortable, Ben Harris, Vice President and Director of Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution, said. He added that Washington already had methods at its disposal to harness the gains from AI. We have really good tools for taxing capital, he said. One option is just to raise the rates. The article continues with a section on profits and promises, including Kathy Hochul, who enacted a statewide moratorium on data center development next year. If you are interested in the rest of this article, please contact the Reading, Niagara Frontier Reading Center. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Carol Pogash has written an article titled, "A Silicon Valley Dirt Farmer Hangs Up His Shears." When Andy Mariani's parents tended their orchards in the Santa Clara Valley nearly a century ago, the region was known as the Valley of Heart's Delight. Blenheim apricots, Bingham Royal Anne cherries, and French prunes with pink and white blossoms bejeweled the land. Silicon eventually replaced the delight, but as crops gave way to computer chips, and million-dollar homes sprouted on former family farms, some 60 acres of Mariani land remain stubbornly fruiting, but not for much longer. If Santa Clara County officials approve, Andy's Orchard, which sits on land his family purchased in 1957, will be sold. Mr. Mariani's 7,000 trees will be uprooted and replaced with hundreds of homes, two parks, a playground, and pickleball courts. Now 80, Mr. Mariani says his once profitable orchard is no longer sustainable. "It's time," he said. "I have hardly any money in the bank." He relies on Social Security payments. Mariani's 280 varieties of stone fruit, chosen for flavor, not shelf life, are cherished in the region. Hundreds attend his summertime tastings. At the Santa Monica Farmers Market, customers line up at 4:30 a.m. for the orchard's baby Crawford peaches, green gage plums, and black Republican cherries. David Karp, a noted fruit writer, calls him the Picasso of stone fruit. Melis Restaurant, with two Michelin stars, serves wedges of Mariani's Arctic J. White nectarines, unadorned on crushed ice, at the end of a 20-course tasting menu. "We always, always, always go to Andy's Orchard," says Ken Takayama, the restaurant's co-chef. "The first time I tried a nectarine they produced, it was as if I had never tasted a nectarine before." Mr. Mariani's fruit is best eaten over the kitchen sink or right from the tree. "When you're out in the orchard," he said, "you don't worry about the juice." When he was young, Mr. Mariani plucked fruit in the orchard next to his family's house, where he still lives. He learned grafting and other farming techniques from his father, who, along with his mother and two oldest siblings, emigrated in the 1930s from the island of Vis, now part of Croatia. Mr. Mariani remembers a seminal moment in his childhood when he tasted a peach his father had grown by grafting an early Crawford peach onto an apricot tree. "I spent my whole lifetime trying to bring back that flavor and relive that joy," he said. His older brothers were expected to operate the orchard. Andy got a master's in public administration. But at 23, he was diagnosed with a rare, debilitating autoimmune disease. He quit work as an assistant city manager in a nearby town and for years suffered at home. Experimental medications eventually helped, and when he was 40, the disease went into remission. "Because of that disease I had, I almost died, and I thought, I want to enjoy my life," Mr. Ronnie said. He returned to the orchard. In his search for fruit that is sweet, acidic, and aromatic, he digs through old nursery catalogs, visits backyard collectors, university collections, and obscure nurseries. In Tashkent, Uzbekistan, a botanist gave him two seeds from golden yellow nectarines. He planted and replanted seeds, selecting the best strain, and it became his Silk Road nectarines. He rescued a peach that the University of California, Davis, had rejected for being too small and delicate for commercial use. Mr. Mariani tasted in it the exotic flavor of his father's Crawford peach. He renamed the fruit Baby Crawford, which became his most popular peach. As Mr. Mariani farmed, his orchard became increasingly locked in. Technology companies like Hewlett-Packard, Apple, Google, and Meta grew, and so did the population. In 1950, when Mr. Mariani was 5, Santa Clara County had 290,547 residents. Today, it has 1.9 million and a raging demand for housing. "Urbanization and farming are incompatible," Mr. Mariani said. Deer and squirrels dine on his fruit. He also copes with an invasive fruit fly, an insidious oak root fungus, and catastrophic climate change, he says. This winter's inadequate chill resulted in almost no baby Crawford peaches or cherries, his largest and traditionally most profitable crops. Farming Mr. Marani's way is expensive. If you grow one variety on 30 acres, you have one method of thinning, pruning, and irrigation. But with so many varieties, cultivation must be customized. Some trees must be picked every other day for 2 weeks, says Jose Garcia, Mr. Mariana's foreman. Sometimes if the fruit turns yellow, that doesn't mean it's ripe. He said, you have to taste it. Mr. Garcia earns $24 an hour and is one of about 15 workers who live rent-free on the farm. All but the newest hires earn above the California minimum wage, Mr. Mariani said. Few work full-time. Most have side jobs. Mr. Garcia, with Mr. Mariana's encouragement, attended college and started a maintenance business. For decades, family farms have been disappearing as corporate farms with lower pricing have expanded and young people find jobs elsewhere. Aging farmers are met with an alternative of developing their land or going broke, says Julie F. Morris, the Santa Clara County agricultural liaison. Unlike soybean, corn, and wheat, she said, specialty fruit is not subsidized by the federal government. The fact that we are losing the land in conditions that created those Blenheim apricots is a tragedy. Mitch Mariani, Andy's older brother, who farms 12 acres, says Blenheim apricots are so delicate you can hardly take them off the street, across the street, without their falling apart. Andy's orchard is one of the few remaining farms that grow the once plentiful fruit. For generations, farmers grew fruit in this region with its alluvial soil, sun-punched summers, and cool winters. At mid-century, an estimated 109,000 acres were orchards. Now fewer than 4,000 acres remain. While other family orchards sold chunks of land to keep their farms going, Mr. Mariani survived by operating a country store where he sells fruit, chocolate-dipped whole apricots, and jams. He also sells wholesale to high-end specialty markets. He calls himself a dirt farmer, which he says is a farmer who earns all his income from farming, as opposed to a gentleman farmer who has money from other sources. Now he's joining their ranks. After a decade of losses, Mr. Mariani agreed with his brother to sell the farm. He never married and has no offspring, and no one in the younger Mariani generation wants to operate a failing business. Manna Investments, a California real estate investment firm, has an option to buy what it calls Mariani Ranch, with plans to build 376 homes. Mr. Mariani and his brother won't discuss the terms of the offer. Scott Murray, a Manna Investments partner, said that at a minimum, 1 acre that is ready to break ground is worth $1 million. When the project is completed, Manna Investment anticipates a revenue of $600 million. An environmental impact report is expected to be completed within a year. Mr. Mariani expects that some orchard workers will return to their families in Mexico and that others will attend school or search for work. And he will move out of the family homestead to a friend's house in town. I'm for preserving agriculture, he said, but not when it's no longer viable. He will continue farming on 20 acres of leased land. Still, he said, the demise of Andy's orchard will be heartbreaking. At this year's final tasting, as Mr. Mariani sat at a weathered chair near the tasting table, a young boy called out, Thank you, Andy, for growing amazing fruit. Mr. Mariani applauded. He was reminded of his father's peach, Crawford peach, and his first taste. That's what I'll miss. I'm trying to give kids the same experience I got. Laura Kelly, under the heading With Interest, reports about 33,575 unsold companies in the portfolios of private equity firms. Deal making is booming, but private equity firms are struggling to sell or take public their companies at a price their investors expect. As of June 30th, these firms had 33,575 unsold companies in their portfolios, according to PitchBook, an industry data firm, up from 32,451 at the end of last year and 15,923 a decade ago. Private equity firms generally buy a company, often using large amounts of debt, then improve its performance and make a profit by exiting the company within a few years. But lately, a combination of factors have upended that formula. The New York Times' Maureen Farrell reported, higher interest rates have made debt more expensive. Artificial intelligence has caused weakness in the software sector, where many companies are owned by private equity. And there is a waning demand from other private equity firms. As the deals slow, private equity firms are underperforming the stock market, presenting challenges for the pension funds, endowments, and other large investors that pay high fees to these firms with the expectation of beating the public markets. The sagging sales contrast with the huge opportunities that venture capital investors are seeing with AI companies like OpenAI, Anthropic, and SpaceX. Through the first half of 2026, was a bustling time for initial public offerings. In general, private equity firms have slowed down such outcomes. Only 70 private equity-backed companies have gone public on the U.S. exchanges since 2022, according to the data firm Dealogic. From 2017 to 2021, 424 went public. Private equity is stuck because those companies have failed to fulfill their value promise. Andrew Milgram, a managing partner and chief investment officer at Marblegate Asset Management, an investment firm, told Ms. Farrell. Strategies by Jeff Summer. Markets continue to roll. Is it time to hedge your bets? The Standard & Poor's 500 is in position for a rare fourth year of gains, and Wall Street is doubling down. The U.S. stock market has been splendid for more than 3 years. It is powered ahead again in 2026, putting the S&P 500 in position for a rare feat, a fourth consecutive year of double-digit gains. That's happened only 3 times since 1928, most recently in the late 1990s. That boom was also fueled by extravagant hopes based on a technological breakthrough. Then it was the internet. Now it's artificial intelligence. The 1990s stretch, when the S&P 500 rose more than 20% each year from 1995 through 1999, had another distinction. It was the only string of 5 consecutive years of double-digit gain in 98 years. In the midst of the current rally, those glorious gains for investors in the 1990s seem bittersweet at best, because they ended with the market crash of 2000 and were followed by an entire decade of miserable returns. During the financial crisis of 2007 to 2009, the Standard & Poor 500 dropped 58% from top to bottom. In 2009, the S&P was lower than it had been in 1999. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Continuing with the article about markets, it's clear that doubling down on the incredible rising stock market was not a good move in the late 1990s, but what about now? Unfortunately, I don't know where the market is heading from here, nor does anybody else. What we do know is what happened in the past. The lessons are simple enough. Stick with the stock market for the long haul, but exercise restraint now by diversifying with low-cost index funds and holding enough cash and bonds to survive the downturns that always come. Timing the market. That's not the message coming from many Wall Street strategists, however, who have become increasingly bullish as the stock market has risen and companies have churned out spectacular earnings. A long-running Bloomberg survey found in July that the consensus forecast for S&P's 500's year-end close had risen about 6% since the end of last year to 8,000. The prevailing outlook has become more positive since, based on a host of higher forecasts that have shown up in my inbox in the last few days, probably reflecting the market's surge past 7,700 this month. Such forecasts have been wildly inaccurate for years, but I follow them closely because they reflect the mood on Wall Street. It's red hot right now, although tempered with a dollop of worry about whether the good times can last. A forecast on Tuesday from Capital Economics, an independent financial research service based in London, is a good example. It called the current market a bubble fueled by AI that will inevitably explode. We envisioned that the bubble inflating a bit more during the rest of this year before bursting. Our N 2026 and N 2027 forecasts for the Standard & Poor 500 are 8250 and 6500, respectively, Capital Economics said. In other words, the market is rising, but will fall sharply sometime next year. So piling into the stock market now and selling before it crashes, exactly when the forecast doesn't say, would be smart if that forecast was right. It's possible that it is, but I'm skeptical. History warns us that most of us will get into trouble if we attempt to make trades based on forecasts like that. In a recent note to clients, Stan Stovall, a market veteran who is now the chief investment strategist of CFRA, an independent financial research firm, pointed out some of the dangers of trying to move in and out of the stock market at apparently opportune times. As a starting point, he considered the buy and hold approach, which requires staying in the markets come what may, even during the terrible decades. That simple strategy, which is what I try to follow, produced an 11.5% annualized return for the S&P from the end of 1987 through the end of last year, Mr. Stovall found. Then he illustrated some of the temptations and pitfalls of varying from this approach. First, he looked at the potential rewards of an impossible feat, timing the market perfectly. Mr. Stovall calculated what an investor's annualized return would have been if she had been prescient enough to have missed only the market's worst days in that period, from December 31st, 1987 through December 31st, 2025, and to have stayed in the market every other day. Missed the 10 worst days, 14.1% annualized. Missed the 20 worst days, 15.1%. Missed the 30 worst days, 16.5%. And missed the 40 worst days, 17.9% annualized. All of these returns would have been wonderful. The problem, of course, is that you wouldn't have known in advance which days to avoid. If you had abandoned the market at the wrong time, you would have missed some eye-popping gains. As I've observed in other columns, the best days for stocks are often clustered near the worst ones, and you can't skip the nightmare without passing up some awesome gains. Mr. Stovall illustrated this conundrum by computing what would have happened to your investment in the S&P 500 over the period if you had missed only the best days. If you missed the 10 best days, 9.3% annualized. Missed the 20 best days, 7.3%. Missed the 30 best days, 6%. And missed the 40 best days, 4.8% annualized. Being absent from the market on the strong days isn't what any investor would want, but that's likely to happen if you stay out of the market at any time. That said, there's no argument about this. You would have been better off with no stock holdings at all between December 31st, 1999 until March 9th, 2009. Which marked the end of the bear market associated with the fiscal crisis. I ran the numbers on FactSet. For the entire period, the cumulative return for the S&P 500 was -46%, including dividends. By contrast, over the same stretch, the Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond Index, a widely followed benchmark for investment-grade bonds, rose 72.3%. Sticking with the stock market in that decade was to experience aggravation and heartache. Bonds were a balm. That's worth remembering now, not as a reason to flee the stock market, but as a reminder to hedge your bets. Heightened risk. The essential problem is that it's impossible to know what the stock market is about to do. Certainly right now, there are many signs that risks are rising. I listed some of them last week. They include the risks of increased inflation, wars and tariffs, questionable use of vast funds of capital for AI, an uncertain direction for the Federal Reserve under new leadership, mounting national debt, and the broad political dysfunction. Interest rates in the bond market have increased, and that makes bonds relatively attractive compared with stocks. Yet Wall Street is doubling down on stocks. Enormous investments in AI and outstanding earnings reports from companies like Alphabet, Microsoft, Nvidia, and Amazon have been propelling the market higher, including dividends. An investment in the S&P 500 has doubled in value since the release of ChatGPT in late November 2022. Market valuation measures, like price-to-earnings ratio, which compares share prices with corporate earnings, are stretched. There are reasons for caution. But if earnings remain strong, it's possible that the overall trend for the stock market will remain upward for months or years. Valuation measures simply aren't useful in predicting short-term moves. But it is also true that rich valuations, like those in the stock market now, do imply constrained returns over the next decade or more, as Robert J. Shiller, the Nobel laureate economist, has shown. So what is an investor to do? There are infinite number of answers. My own conclusion is to keep it simple and forget about market timing and stock picking completely. Instead, I stick with broad stock index funds all times and always hold bonds and cash too. I tweak my asset allocation slightly from time to time, depending mainly on my personal life. I haven't bulked up on stocks because of the latest rally. Instead, over the years, as I've aged, I've slowly ratcheted down risk by reducing stock allocations. There could well be another bad decade ahead, but the great days for stocks will also almost certainly be coming, and I'd hate to miss them. In praise of the altar of get ready routines. An article by Rukmini Kalamachi under the heading of real estate. TikTok has helped revive the popularity of dressing tables, also known as vanities. Nearly three centuries ago, the business of governing the world ran past a woman's dressing table. It's the year 1748, and Europe has just emerged from a devastating continental war. Empires were being divided, borders redrawn. That December, when the grounds at Versailles were dark and dreary, an extraordinary line had formed inside the palace. It wasn't outside the king's apartment, nor his ministers. For hours on end, courtiers, ambassadors, financiers, and noblemen pressed themselves against the narrow staircase leading to the apartment of a woman who had no official government role, some carrying petitions, others rehearsing arguments. Inside her chamber, sumptuously decorated in green silk and damask, Madame de Pompadour, who had recently become the king's mistress, sat at her toilet, her dressing table, as servants applied her powder and rouge and tended to her cascading curls. The other day, the crowd stretched all the way to the bottom of the staircase, waiting for her to start getting ready. A former French Secretary of State wrote in his diary on December 28, 1748, according to the material collected by the leading Pompadour expert, Susan Wager, an associate professor of art history at the University of New Hampshire and author of a forthcoming book about her. "Every important matter now passes through her," wrote the nobleman, expressing dismay that the ambassadors were no longer received in a council chamber, but were instead escorted straight to her dressing table. A piece of furniture designed for a private ritual, the art of getting ready, had become one of Europe's most influential stages. Now, 278 years later, after nearly disappearing from bedrooms in America and beyond, the dressing table, or vanity, is making an unlikely comeback. Only this time, the people clamoring for them are not the mistresses of kings, they're girls as young as five. A special place. Last year, it came out of left field when Joanna Moya began asking her parents, repeatedly and insistently, for a word that sounds remarkably grown up for a five-year-old, a vanity. She began saving up her commissions, the word her parents used for her allowance, earning a few dollars for cleaning up her toys, a little more for watering the plants, and $5 for every book she finished at the family's home in New Jersey. The goal was a piece of furniture she couldn't yet fully use. She isn't allowed to wear makeup. Her vanity, a hot pink desk with compartments and an oval mirror ringed with lights, arrived in time for her sixth birthday. Joanna uses it as a desk, including to do her homework and to write in her diary. She also brushes her hair and puts on moisturizer. Mostly, she uses it to play Get Ready For Me. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times business section of the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, continuing the story about vanities. My vanity is special because I sometimes look in the mirror and my mirror lights up, she explained. I sometimes pretend to film videos looking at the mirror. The little girl's dressing table bears almost no resemblance to the elaborate vanities that once stood outside the apartments at Versailles. Instead of tulip wood adorned with bronze, hers is made of manufactured wood, assembled with screws and dowels, which arrived in a cardboard box from Wayfair, costing $129.99. It looks similar to dozens of options now readily available from Walmart, IKEA, Target, West Elm, Urban Outfitters, and other retailers. According to Pinterest, interest in dressing tables has gone through the roof, especially recently. In the past year, searches for modern bedroom vanity spiked 741%. Latest dressing table is up 662%, while vanity table bedroom is up 298%. Yet the furniture itself may be beside the point. What Joanna wanted wasn't simply a place to brush her hair. It was a place to perform the ritual she'd been watching online, getting ready. That ritual is older than the furniture built to contain it. The vanity began not as a table, but as a box. In ancient Egypt, women stored cosmetics in wooden boxes. Centuries later, the French gave it a name, not just for the furniture, but to the ritual itself. The toilette, derived from toil, the cloth spread across a table before a woman's brushes, combs, and cosmetics were laid out, described not just the dressing table itself, but the act of prepping oneself. It goes from an object to a process, says Jane Adlin, the curator of the Metropolitan Museums of Art's 2013 exhibition on the vanity. The ritual reached its apogee in the 18th century when Madame de Pompadour transformed getting ready into a political performance, an act that made her relevant and powerful. The Industrial Revolution brought the once exclusive object to the masses, and by the 1950s, it became a fixture of the IKEA catalog. Then almost as quietly as it arrived, it began to disappear. By the 1990s, the vanity had all but vanished from IKEA and other retailers. It went extinct, said Daniela Ohad, a design historian, who associates the vanity's decline with the move into smaller homes, which was accompanied by a move away from male and female furniture. A baby version of stardom. For centuries, the furniture existed because women practiced the ritual. When the furniture disappeared, the ritual did not. Then in 2007, something unexpected happened. The ritual became public once more. A 20-year-old art student in Florida named Michelle Phan began posting makeup tutorials on YouTube. She wasn't the first beauty vlogger, but her videos took off, and soon she was one of the platform's most popular beauty gurus. Others followed, transforming YouTube into the epicenter of a new kind of intimate performance. Teenagers and young women inviting strangers to watch them get ready. Those early videos weren't formed at elegant dressing tables. Most were shot in bathrooms. Over the next few years, the format evolved. Beauty creators stopped simply explaining how they applied their eyeliners and began talking about their breakups, parents, ambitions, and politics. Taylor Lorenz, author of Extremely Online, who once worked at the New York Times, explained, "It would be like, hey guys, welcome to my eyeliner tutorial. Then, hey guys, oh my gosh, let me tell you about, like, my parents are getting divorced." In that same period, beginning in 2007, IKEA reintroduced its toilet board, Swedish for dressing table, in a line called the Malm, said Wojciechowska, a furniture product developer for IKEA's bedroom furniture. By 2013, hashtag GRWM was both a hashtag and an acronym for Get Ready With Me, and prevalent enough that it would eventually earn its own entry in dictionary.com. Then came Instagram, TikTok, and the pandemic. "What it's become is a baby version of stardom," said the influencer Eloise Dufka, 26. Ms. Dufka got her first vanity from IKEA when she was 11. Today, her vanity has migrated from her bedroom to the office of her Manhattan apartment. Within just a few years, she had signed deals with beauty brands, including Estee Lauder and Lancome, and now travels the world as a model and influencer. The vanities have proliferated in the hashtag GRWM era, and they're cheap, but with two non-negotiable features: a mirror rimmed in LEDs and a built-in phone charger. Helen Willow's version in Metairie, Louisiana, which sells for $172, has both. She owns two. After her parents split, she argued that if she got the bed in each house, she needed a vanity in each house too. "I practically live here," she said of her dressing table. "I'm 13 years old. I love talking, making new friends, and sharing my life on social media. Those activities make her feel seen as well as connected." Data collected by the Kearney Consumer Institute shows that the money spent on beauty products has spiked since the pandemic, and that the buyers are getting younger, said Catherine Black, the Institute's lead retail partner. "Consumers are also much more aware of how their homes look. They're very conscientious of the scenery, of how they're filming, as well as what they're filming," she says. "A big piece of vanity is just that. What's my background?" The behavior is now peer-reviewed. A 2025 study published in the journal Pediatrics found that TikTok skincare videos aimed at teenagers typically featured 6 products per routine, but sometimes more than a dozen. The findings closely mirror what parents and retailers are observing. Getting ready routines among young girls are becoming increasingly elaborate, highly visible, and widely shared online, says Rahul Sharma, a representative of Mordor Intelligence, which tracks consumer trends. For many parents, the trend has produced conflicted feelings. In Montclair, New Jersey, Ishida Rapina wasn't sure what to do when her 11-year-old daughter, Blake, presented a PowerPoint before Christmas, a polished, data-driven version of a letter to Santa. She had measured a room, identified the vanity she wanted, and explained why it was this year's must-give gift. "It's this tension of not wanting to be so focused on looks," Ms. Rapino said, explaining her reticence. Yet she also remembers growing up with strict immigrant parents who discouraged makeup. "It makes you feel like you don't fit in. I want her to feel like she's part of what her friends are doing." In bedrooms like her daughter's, the vanity has come full circle. The tulip wood has given way to particle board, but once again a crowd has gathered to watch a young woman getting ready. Viewers just do so through a screen. So far this year, Stocks are up. The Standard & Poor's is up 13.7%. Mortgage rates are also up. The Bankrate.com 30-year fixed is 6.77%, which is up 0.57 points. And jobless claims are down. The four-week moving average is down minus 9.1%. A quote from Philip Koopman, a Carnegie Mellon emeritus professor, on how an autonomous car may react when it encounters something unexpected. When it's in a novel situation, it's prone to overconfidence and spectacularly stupid failure. A quote from Lydia Bosur, a senior economist at the consulting firm EY Parthenon. We have a labor market that's stable, but stuck in second gear. And a quote from Howard Polskin, who publishes The Writing, a newsletter that tracks right-wing news media on the decline in visitors to Trump's social media site. I have been following traffic on Truth Social for years, and I am really stuck by the steepness of the plunge. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features in the August 16th issue of the New York Times Business Section. We read from the New York Times Business Section every Thursday at 11 a.m. Your reader has been Val. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the USA Today. Following that at 2 o'clock, we have episode number 2 of A World Appears by Michael Pollan. Stay with us for these readings and more.